Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hello, friends. It's me.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bryce Castillo, and that's me.
We may be joined later on by Mr. Brian Brushwood, who is attending other matters, but may jump right in if he shows up. Gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. What's up, Andrew?
I want to present to you a vision. You know, you think about strife and the problems and other parts of the world, the Middle Eastern conflict, where you have different sides, different points of views. And I think, you know, when I go to Disney World, I see everybody getting along. I see people from around the world having fun, risking heat stroke, long lines, but still, you know, enjoying, you know, this most magical place on Earth.
A fun day out with the family.
Everybody's together. You get in line. We're all the same, except for the people who pay for, like, you know, private escorts from Disney and, you know, jump ahead of the line or get all the fast passes they can use and because they're more important. That's fine.
Who would do that all day?
Yeah. Point is, it's a place where everybody gets together. It's a place of peace and harmony. Amusement parks do that. Entertainment does that. That's a powerful thing about amusement parks, entertainment. What I'm proposing is we do that in a place where there's a lot of conflict, okay, like the Middle East, okay? You know, we go do something like that there. We build an amusement park. We build something where everybody can kind of get along, come together and say, oh, well, I'll take our children there. We'll all have fun.
Okay. I mean, everyone
deserves. You think this as a form of, like, foreign aid that we're like, all right, in a country that is maybe getting over some kind of major issue that is on the rebound, we say, you want to know what? We're going to work with, you know, maybe we contract through Disney or Universal or something else, or maybe we hire, we bring in, the Pentagon brings in Imagineers. So we create an amusement park where only rule is that people have to be okay.
Pentagon. Let's not bring in some of the people who are maybe involved militarily in this. Let's make this more of a homegrown thing. Okay. Let's make it like kind of something more authentic and more to the region kind of thing. So like, let's go to the West Bank. Let's say, let's build something there in the West Bank that everybody can enjoy.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. It's a disputed area, very heavily disputed, long history there, but let's build something there that all parties can enjoy. And let's not favorite, you know, maybe, you know, our side or whatever by like, hey, we're going to build Disney there or whatever. Okay.
Sure.
Let's build something that's more central there. Like, you know, something local flavor, but avoid politics and history. Let's maybe make it more natural.
Okay. Well, I see that there's like a little water feature, maybe like a West Bank water park.
You don't want to get into that.
Oh, okay.
Problem of the water park, Bryce, is that there are certain cultural norms on what's appropriate and what's not.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Maybe like wildlife. Maybe we build like a wildlife park there.
Like a sanctuary. You go
see. Yeah. I think I know where we're going. And I think it's where we were last week. But I'm very excited to have this conversation with Andrew here. But please let's see if I'm right.
Oh, was this the topic last week?
Well, we had a very specific idea about the news story from Egypt that you sent along last week.
No, it's not that.
Okay. We will have to regroup on dog park though.
Yeah. No. This is forget zebra donkey park. No, it's totally different. Totally different.
Okay. Good. All right. Perfect. Good.
Yeah, no. We're going to local again. As we're going to do something local though. We'll do something local like an animal attraction kind of thing. I think that everybody likes animals, right?
Sure.
Every religious book mentions animals, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as long as we're not eating the animals, we're fine.
Is it a fable that has to include an animal?
A fable?
I think fables generally have animals, yeah.
Yeah, that's like a thing is a fable. So as long as there have been the ancient fables, there have been animals that we have read personality and taken life lessons from.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, this is the idea. This is the bold vision. Okay. What we do is we build kind of a cool attraction, something neat, something you could, like, maybe something you might see one of there, but we'll put like a lot of them, like a thousand of them there.
A thousand of any animal would be a sight to behold.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like a hard thing to even keep track of. A thousand of anything.
Anything. Even with trackers.
Hard to, like, yeah, you can easily go from that to 997 real quick. You know, you only get so many eyeballs.
Yeah.
All right. Let's think about possible ideas. What do we want to put there?
Donkeys painted
like zebras. Sure. It's been done.
So a thousand of any one animal?
One animal. Yeah.
Well, what are adorable? I mean, like, because you can do a lot of things that are small, and you might even be able to get it at a price.
Like, we have some space. Doesn't it be small? It can be
like,
bigger.
You know, it's kind of a hotter part of the world. Maybe something like a meerkat.
So, ooh, meerkats. You know, okay. Little, okay.
One of those little guys.
I mean, yeah, we can think of, bunnies.
Bunnies. Okay. Yeah. Armadillos. If you get enough armadillos, get a little bumper ball action.
Oh, that'd be fun. We're gonna get back to dogs because we do have to run this dog park idea by Andrew. But maybe I'll tell you what. Maybe it's even something a little bit like a snake.
Oh, okay. Snake's good. Snake's something in, you know, something indigenous there.
Yeah.
I propose crocodiles.
Ooh,
okay. All right. So crocodiles. That seems like to make it humane, right? That you would need a fairly large. I mean, because now we're at more animal preserve than we are, like just an
attraction,
an exhibit somewhere, an attraction, right?
And you need a lot of space. Like alligators are very.
Well, these are crocs. You can pile them on top of each other. They're kind of fine.
Sure. Bunk crocs.
So
what I'm saying is,
wait a minute, are you talking about a crocopile?
Oh, that's very good.
Don't encourage him, Grace. We're talking about an amusement park in the West Bank featuring 1,000 crocodiles.
That's
okay. Wait, hold on. You're saying this is a real thing? 1,000 crocodiles in the West Bank.
It could be a real thing.
It could. Okay. Could. Well.
It and it could was be, a real thing.
It was.
Some crazy entrepreneur decided to build an attraction in the West Bank featuring 1,000 crocodiles. He had two problems. One, in a war-torn area, people really don't feel like going to an amusement park or large groups. No. Two, they kind of were prone to escaping, and 70 of them had managed to get loose.
How many?
70.
70!
Well, and also it's like, look, if it were just 1,000 kittens and it's like, oh man, look, I live in a war torn country. We are a proud but suffering people. We have a constant tension with our neighbors that may or may not be ever resolved, let alone in my lifetime. I'm going to go out of my way. I'm going to bring the kids. I'm going to see a bunch of kitties and we're going to feel really nice. These kitties are rolling around with each other. I can't imagine being like, hey, kids, get in the car. We're going to go see a pile of scaly, looks to be killing death machines that are touchy and biting each other. Like, that just does not seem to be something
How
that would
dare you say that, Justin, hailing from Florida, where the proud home of Gatorland.
I'm just saying, and Gatorland is kind of like, it's got its own vibe, and you don't leave Gatorland thinking, oh, that's so sweet. Like, you would leave Gatorland saying, man, gators are cool. They're dangerous, and they're cool, and that possibly drunk alligator wrestler certainly did hold his snout together with his chin. Like, that's what you leave seeing Gatorland. You don't leave seeing Gatorland and being like, I need to bind more with my community. The universal truth of love is something I now understand more of.
So how long – you said this was a while ago. How long ago was
– I guess you started as back in like 1987, but it never – I don't think it ever really fully took off. Shocking.
No kidding.
And, yeah, the problem is that he's got this attraction that nobody goes to, and he's got all these crocodiles and doesn't know what to do with them. He can't send them elsewhere.
Because they're not indigenous to the land, are they?
Crocodiles are from that area.
Oh, okay, okay.
So that's still there? These crocodiles?
I found news stories as old as like 4 days ago of hundreds of crocodiles still just stuck there.
Oh my God! Nobody knows what to do with them. This is like the Israeli version of We Bought a Zoo.
Locals worry the creatures may escape for a third time. Holy crap. That's... Oh.
Imagine yourself a child growing up in the West Bank, not comprehending the politics of what's going on, feeling a little bit stateless, rootless, what have you. You know, your parents argue, you watch the news, you're getting conflicting things in your head, and now you have to deal with the sheer terror if there's a crocodile farm nearby with 1,000 crocs get loose at any moment.
Dead Polymers in our chat says, sounds like a business opportunity for a crocodile shoemaker. I've been, Andrew and I have both separately been to Israel. I have many Israeli friends. I grew up with Israelis. I can tell you for a fact that multiple times a year, he's got somebody rolling up on him saying, it's no big deal. I take them away, a dollar a crocodile. I get it off your hands. I get it off your hands. No problem. I guarantee you somebody has rolled up and made an offer for a dollar a head to skin all these crocodiles.
Owner Gadi Batan, who had hoped to sell the crocs for their skin before a new law made this illegal, was attempting to move the reptiles to a new home in Cyprus.
In 2012, Israel passed a law making the crocodile a protected animal, banning their sale as meat or merchandise, making the plan untenable.
You just leave the fence open. You leave the fence open. Pop, pop, boom. We are done. We are done. They get away. They get away. Where could you find them? Nobody could.
When it's like crocodiles aren't it would be easy to say crocodiles are not an endangered species. No one is in need of live crocodiles, generally.
Oh, why don't you speak for everybody, Bryce? Nobody's in need of live crocodiles.
I'm just saying, I don't know of any part of the world where the circle of life is missing high-level predators like crocodiles.
Right,
let's talk
idea.
About your dog park.
the dog park is a very separate issue.
I'm just saying, Instagram ads targeted at drug dealers. Like, yes. just make an Instagram ad of, like, you want to be the real baller? Get a crocodile.
Oh, that's what...
I wreck from the HQ of all the most badass crocodiles.
Didn't you see Jurassic Park 3?
Yes.
I did not.
I mean, excuse me, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Sorry, Fallen Kingdom.
No. Oh, the new one? No, I didn't see that yet.
No, and, man, like... Let me, spoiler alert, you find out how surprisingly easy it is to have a flash sale for dinosaurs.
Really?
Huh. Hey, we got them. Bring in the bidders.
They start selling dinosaurs?
The models we sell, it is just like, wow. I believe we can bring back dinosaurs. I don't believe this thing can work like this way. I mean, it's so absurd.
It's movie magic.
This guy can't even unload 1,000 crocodiles and then, you know.
So maybe what he does, if the park is still open, he rebrands it. The world's most thievable park. We are not watching. You just let people come in.
Right.
Wait, charge them $200.
So
and whatever they do.
In Crocodile Park, you're calling it Open Theft World. And your tagline is, we're not watching.
No one's watching. Or no, the what's his name? Baton? Baton's Croc Park. Don't worry, those cameras aren't hooked up to anything.
Yeah, please steal from us. No employees, no prices.
Everything must go.
Yeah, I mean, but not because we really, by law, we can't let any of these things fall into the wrong hands. And then he just writes in capital letters, wink.
He writes wink, yeah. You get a free crocodile holder on exit.
Oh, yeah. That's the only thing. Just stock next to it is like one of those pool things where you can grab stuff out of the pool.
Oh, that's Skimmer. Yeah.
Oh, you know what we do is they put like CROC, croc outlet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go. See, that's something you could do. That's
crazy. I mean, because he just has to pay for a whole park. right? I mean, I guess really the only thing would be trying to sell the land to somebody else and trying to make it their problem. But even then, like, who's going to buy land with a bunch of wild ass crocodiles on it?
Talking to Six Flags right now, like, oh, it's great location. You know, weather's, you know, really warm year round.
You will love it.
And it's in the West Bank and full of crocodiles. Other than that.
Yeah. The flora and the fauna is great. So this is something from the Independence reporting. The crocodiles, which could live well into their 70s, are also reproducing. Female crocodiles lay 60 eggs at a time, though only a few survive in the wild. It is nonetheless thought that the numbers in Israel could grow to thousands in coming years.
Wow. So what if these become so ubiquitous that they overrun elements of Israel and Palestine? And this is the uniting force that brings these two warring factions together.
A third party?
No. The defeat of the incurring crocodile invasion.
Yeah.
The crocodile menace is finally what brings a two-state solution to prosperity.
The crocodiles are the White Walkers of this situation, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Crocodiles are the White Walkers of the Game of Thrones known as the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Yes.
that could happen, I bet, if there was a sudden invasion. Like there's a quote here. I don't want to think what will happen if a crocodile manages to escape and reaches the Jordan River, and then we'll have an international incident. Who knows? Maybe crocodiles will bring peace to the Middle East.
Dare to dream. You know, it's one of the problems you have with, you know, war and, you know, upheavals in countries is you get people who are, you know, stateless people. You get refugees. You get people who have, you know, find themselves the victims of a situation and have no place to go. You know, the number of people living in refugee camps is huge, and it's a very, very sad thing. And it's not, you know, for lack of resources, things like this. It's politics. And, you know, in a micro way, this is kind of that sort of example of this. You know, when you have conflicts in places like Syria and other places, and you look what happens, and, you know, there are large communities of people that, you know, you have been refugees for so long that, you know, it's hard to identify, you know, what your state is. You know, it's sad. So it's kind of a parable, you know, for the situation for refugees around the world.
Well, I think it's a fable because it has animals.
I think we determined it was a fable. Yeah.
Sorry. So I don't have a solution, guys. Don't know.
Add that to the pile in that region of problems.
Even like this law getting passed about, like, you know, you're not being able to export them. Was this like his brother-in-law trying to spite him? You know, like they had an argument, you know, 20 years ago, like, oh, the crocodile farm, dumbest idea in the world. Like, oh yeah, watch me, you know? And then he's like, I don't know, do these crocodiles. And then the Knesset, you know, a law gets passed overnight, you know? Patan, so sorry to hear. You can't move the – what do you mean? Oh, you didn't hear about the law that got passed.
Well, and also that law is like only 6 years old. This dude had a long time to get rid of these crocs or try to offload them too.
I don't know when he took it over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. If someone,
maybe. I don't know.
I can't imagine that this is an easy problem to solve. I don't imagine that this is something that people are very – like, you're like, oh no, that's fine. Yeah, just the SEO on crocodile removal that's a real expensive ad word because it's getting so much traffic.
Mm-hmm. Oh wait, I think we have the solution to this.
Oh,
a crocodile cryptocurrency.
There we go. Based on the breeding population,
ICO introductory crocodile offering.
Coinodile. Coinodile.
Each croc represents one croc coin.
Croc coin. Is there.
Yeah, a crocodollar.
Instead of a blockchain, we have a croc chain.
A croc chain!
the only thing full of croc will be your wallet.
That's right. Like each croc.
I want everybody, all the audio listeners, I'm just like, if I had symbols, I would just be chiming them together like a monkey. It delighted me so much, the croc chain.
With 128 teeth encryption.
Yes.
Oh my goodness,
we may be onto something here. We've got a solution, because, like, you know, sometimes you want to base, like, which company is it that does, like, the firewall Like you're gonna have you can route your website the traffic through there.
Oh, Cloudflare.
Yeah, like I think they use like lava lamps to generate like their cryptographic like random numbers and stuff.
I've heard that random.org uses webcams. They get crappy old webcams and they point them at like a wall or something, and they use the grain from like unusable images to come up with random
numbers. I think some things might be these might be overtly clever, but still it's fun. But like that's the idea, is that like, you know, we have this randomization of a croc bark and their genomes and there's all these other things there. Like,
Oh man.
I don't know. You know what's not blockchain? You know it's not crypto or whatever the thing right now is.
Yeah.
It's our good old fashioned podcast, the Weird Things Podcast.
That's right.
And we're overflowing with episodes, you know, of course. And if you want to keep that happening, it's a good thing. You should consider supporting us.
Yeah. Every week we bring it to you loud and live and full of crocs and all sorts of two zoo ideas in a week or in a row. But that's the free business advice that we're giving to you here.
Yeah, we brought a zoo topic 2 weeks in a row, and you can support us if you like it by going over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Not only do you get that, but you also get our After Things podcast. It's where we talk about a little bit more of the nitty-gritty entrepreneurial kind of stories. So if you have a project or something that you're looking to launch, this is the best way to go about it. Listen, everybody's support is tremendously appreciated, and you can join the team over there at patreon.com/weirdthings.
So the dream is dead. It died.
Oh, I'm
sorry, guys.
Okay, wait. Do we want to talk? Can we pitch you this dog park before or after this?
Oh, yeah, no. All right, so let's go.
So last week, if you missed the episode, please go check it out. We talked about another sighting of a zoo in Egypt, in Cairo, I believe, where they had painted a mule to look like a zebra. They had painted the stripes. Right. And people noticed that it was not a zebra because A, it didn't look anything like a zebra, and B, the stripes were starting to run.
So we got to talking about dogs and whether or not we could take different kinds of dogs and with no pain to them and certainly no more humiliation than many dogs get put through by their owners putting crazy clips and bows in their hair, making them wear little outfits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We basically just primarily through haircuts and maybe very basic costuming have an entire park. Let's say maybe on a 7-acre piece of land outside of Austin, we basically turn it into a dog zoo where you are constantly, well, you're looking through all these dogs that are very well kept, they're very well taken care of, and there's no pain to them. Whether or not you could have a dog zoo where they look like other animals. So we were looking at a dog as a panda. There are many as lions and tigers. There's a million different versions of it.
And our camel.
Here's a camel. So our question was, because having had even some experience with the, I don't know if I should name the very famous animal rights organization that my wife used to fundraise for, but if you're thinking of one, it's probably that
one. American Beef Council, go ahead.
Right, the ABF.
I don't know if that would even necessarily be like against their rule. I mean, they are in general very much against zoos, but if these are all dogs that are rescues and stuff like that, and they're well taken care of, I don't know how much different that is from like a shelter. You're just making, I'm sure you'd have to have an altruistic kind of element to it. So I guess two questions. Number one, dog zoo, interesting idea or not. Question the second, is it something that would not immediately be protested? Is there some ethical element that we are overlooking here?
One, I think everything will immediately get protested. I just sent Bryce. I don't know if you guys saw this one.
We did the Chinese zoo that dressed up a Tibetan Mastiff as a lion. Yeah,
as a lion.
Get the hell out of here. Unless you're at the dog zoo. And then you're like, oh, look, that little dog looks like a lion. That's how cute. To. Hooray.
Right? Like, wouldn't you love to go and see all your favorite Disney friends?
Oh, jeez.
Well, we're gonna get sued there. Jesus, though. What nightmare fuel.
All of these ones that are like multiple things on a dog are very hard to look at. But the rest of them are pretty good. This was just a dragon. This was just a dog with a dragon painted on its side. But it's not even the right way. It's facing the back.
It's like, well, the dog with the dragon on my van.
Oh, maybe he lights his farts. Maybe that's why he's...
None of these dogs look happy that have this crazy weird painting on it. Yeah, I don't. I think yes, you're gonna have problems. I think yes. A chat room, they're pointing out that this organization will probably, yeah. I mean, they would rather euthanize your dog than have it be humiliated as they see it. So, problematic from there. But listen, is that gonna stop a dream? You can stop a vision that somebody won't be happy with it. You know.
Sure. All right. So I guess, and let's taking that specific organization out of it. Do you think that it's something that could find an audience? Is there a craftsmanship to sculpting a dog's hair in a funny way that you could run them around?
I mean, like a little queen.
Come on,
Hercule dog.
I'm sure there could be an audience for this. I think that, you know, you'd want to put it someplace where you're like Orlando or someplace, or you know, Branson, you know, someplace where you already have tourist audiences coming through there, and say, hey, while here, come check out Dog Zoo. Yeah.
Well, look at this dog cow. This looks like
animals. This dog. I'm be honest with you guys, like, I'm a little uncomfortable with this, and I'm considering protesting this.
Oh, really?
No!
Oh, these poor animals. Oh. Oh, God, no.
This one's bad.
I'm sorry. These ones are
We're looking
awful.
At a dog that the front half is made to look like a tiger, and the back half is the leg is the trunk of an elephant, and it's like an elephant face the other way.
Like, some of them, they really are trying hard, but this dog does not look
it's
happy.
It's horrible. This is horrible. I'm protesting, guys. I'm sorry.
Could do cyberpunk.
My God, I'm getting my picket sign right now. Oh.
Oh. Right, but look, but that one's just a tiger. That's more what we're looking at here. Just look at that one, a zebra pup. That pup looks happy.
Yeah. I don't know, guys. I don't know.
Jeez. All right. Back to the drawing board. I guess Brian's gonna have to figure out something else to do with that 7-acre land that he just bought.
Yeah.
Some crocodiles. I'm telling you, crocodiles. gentlemen. Scientists have discovered a rogue object, which they thought initially might have been a brown dwarf, you know, like a failed star, you know, like, or are stars just brown dwarfs with just way too much ego? I don't know. Who's to decide?
Yeah.
But now they think it may not actually be a brown dwarf. They think it may just be a large, you know, bigger than Jovian sized planet. So the object, SIMPJO136566, or SIMP013 for short, 12 times the mass of Jupiter. It might be a wandering exoplanet. Another example that we found of the possibility that there could be rogue planets. Rogue planets are planets which are not attached to or orbiting any particular star, but are drifting through the cosmos. And what's interesting about rogue planets is that there's some estimates put the number of rogue planets equal to or maybe vastly greater than the number of planets that are actually in orbit around star systems. And these were planets that at some point formed, you know, in the stellar disk that forms planets and stars. And then for some reason, some gravitational force, maybe they came in contact with another star, a larger object, whatever, pulled them out of their orbit and they went drifting apart. And when you look at your sky and you look at like, hey, those are stars between here and Alpha Centauri and just one or two light years of space around us, there could be dozens of these, could be a large number of these objects. We're now realizing that in our outer solar system, there may be a massive object, which there's gaining evidence for that. There could be, you know, what do we call it? Do we call it Planet Nine? Because some people demoted Pluto on questionable grounds, or we call it Planet 10, et cetera, whatever. But there could be more of these.
How close is that? Would this planet be compared to other like viable Earth-like planets that we've found?
Well, this would be a very inhospitable place to try to live in. It's 12 times the mass of Jupiter, so it would be not something we'd want to live on. But are you talking the one in the outer solar system, or
sure,
like
yeah.
planet? Let's start that one is like you're like 1,000 astronomical units or something. It's far out. You know, it's mm-hmm. Our closest star system, you know, Alpha Centauri and Proxima Centauri are like 3.5 light years away. This thing is not quite a light year away, but it's far out. But yeah. still, you know, within the realm of places we could go to and we could conceivably figure out how to go to, it's possible, you know, eventually.
Do you think that is it coming towards our solar system, or is it sort of just passing us by? Is there
which one are we talking about? Planet X or
the one that's close to in the outer star solar system?
Planet X, it's orbiting. It is part of our solar system. Okay. What we believe this to be there because we look at the pattern of Oort cloud objects, things in our outer solar system, and it looks like there's some strong attractor which is affecting their orbits. So it's been part of our solar system for a considerable amount, you know, for a long time. So it's in orbit. You know, it's just a very, very distant orbit and a very slow orbit.
Yeah.
But that's not a rogue. You know, that's you know, a planet in orbit. But there could be other objects that could even be drifting in between the space between where we are and it is, between that space, because it hasn't been gravitationally, it has enough velocity not to be captured, you know. There are a lot of, because the point is there are in our solar system, there could be more objects the size of Mars way out there, way, way out there. You know, that's the thing that we're realizing now is that it's not this sort of very clean numbers. They all add up. Yeah, you get 9 or so, you know, planets. You know, we used to wonder, did other stars have planets? Now we know, yeah, planets are kind of the norm. And then now we have an idea of what our solar system looks like, but when you go much further out and you're talking about objects that reflect almost no light, it's really hard to detect. And so now we're trying to figure out what's out there.
So you mentioned the exoplanet that we thought was a brown dwarf. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the ramifications of reclassifying this or drilling down, refining what
we know? Anytime we discover something that falls outside of what we expected to discover, and we know that we've only been looking at a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of the sky, is you have to sort of make the assumption, you know what, this may not be a rarity, this might be very common. You know, when you see something, you need to go like something like that, where you go like, wow, there may be a lot more of these things. And that was the thing about exoplanets, or, you know, rogue planets, was the idea that, like, you know, looking at the math, like, man, it's possible for planets to escape, you know, the orbits here. And like, man, let's do some math. Like, there might be a lot of these, and it might not be a rarity. It might be a more common thing. And so, like, these failed, you know, stars, these, you know, failed brown dwarfs, these Jovian-sized objects that don't emit enough light for us to see, that only, you know, vaguely emit maybe, you know, some other, you know, frequencies, those might be really common, and there might be a lot of stuff. And when we look up into the night sky and we see the stars and we see the planets closest to us, there could be thousands of objects, you know, in our field of view that are just too dim to recognize unless you put a telescope in one spot and let it just, you know, focus on one area of sky.
Man, that's interesting, because I think, like, it really puts into perspective how dark space really is, right? The fact mm-hmm. that, like, if there's no light, we may not be able to see it. You know, I know we have methods of using light and you know, wave reading waves to kind of get an idea of what, you know, the composition of outer planets are. But, you know, if there are hidden exoplanets just, you know, outside of the view of a star, man.
Yeah, this one, which is about 20 light years from Earth, which is considered very, very close. And what's interesting is that it has extremely intense magnetic field, a huge, huge magnetic field we're trying to explain, which could mean that this thing is spinning, you know, which is, you know, thing could be spinning, and an object that large, very likely it could have moons orbiting it. And you just, you know, we get into, you know, there was a big realization in the 19th century with when the microscopes became, you know, much better. And we started looking at smaller levels. We realized that, you know, there was a whole element of life that was right before our eyes we didn't understand, you know, bacteria. You know, we started looking at single cell organisms and realizing these things were all around us. Looking at water, you thought it was just water, and you saw, you know, zooplankton, all these other things just floating around in there. And all of a sudden, we're like, whoa, this whole microscopic kingdom is kind of bigger than our own. And now in astronomy, we're looking out there and saying, you know, we could see stars, and we could, first it was just, we realized there are planets beyond the ones that we could see with the naked eye. And that was, you know, the telescope allowed us to see. And then now we're going further out and find out, like, there's so many other objects and kinds of things out there that we had no idea were there. And it sort of changes our picture of space.
Yeah.
So do you think that we'll be able to map more of this as just it's easier to put things up into space, like telescope-wise or other sensors?
Yeah, absolutely. And you understand that, like, you know, we've had this James Webb Space Telescope for the, you know, it was proposed, I think, back in the 1990s. And this was supposed to be, you know, a fantastic telescope observing planets and one of the most advanced telescopes we've had. And the budgets kept creeping up. They've had problems and it's been delayed. And it's one of these things. And, you know, you were really victims of the sunk, you know, the sunk cost fallacy, where we don't want to say, hey, let's just stop this and redo it, you know, start over. The reason that it's so attractive is the fact that this telescope would allow us to see so much more. We'd be able to observe so many more things if we have it there. Mm-hmm. And that's why researchers are, you know, hesitant to say, like, well, let's scrap it and start over, because clearly this program has a number of problems. When something that started off as like an $400 million project is now costing $20 billion, you know, that's mission creep.
Hey, but, listen, I'm not a math major, but that seems like more money to me.
But in those price jumps, though, has been increased capabilities and other stuff, and it's become the version we have today is different before. I mean, and that's like, you know, I have my own issues with these projects that just balloon and keep going on and on. But I do understand the scientific impact of that is that it would allow us to see some amazing stuff. We're already making amazing discoveries. And anytime we can improve what we're doing, you improve the resolution a little bit more, what's capable. It's incredible, you know.
We mentioned Space Force back when it first kind of floated around, but there was some official movement on it. Did you follow the speech by Vice President Pence? And is it anything mm-hmm. different than you initially assumed or thought Space Force would be?
So, yeah, I mean, to reiterate, Vice President Pence came out and sort of, you know, elaborated a bit more on the next steps for establishing a Space Force. And we've talked about a lot about Space Force, and I've written about in my books, like Station Breaker and Orbital, you know, kind of like an idea about where these things might evolve to. And you certainly have to separate the message from the messenger. That's the first thing I ask people to separate the idea from where it came from. And President Trump is not the first person to suggest a Space Force. It's not like just some crazy idea that was just thought of, you know, in this current administration. It's been talked about before. And there are pros and cons to this. Anytime you establish an entirely new branch of the government, it becomes very expensive and costly, and there's problems that arise from that. But that doesn't mean there is not a need for this. You know, back in the 1990s, there was talk about, like, hey, do we need to have a branch of the government that deals with computer security and things like this? One branch that specifically understands the needs and stuff like this. Now, what we had groups like the NSA understanding security for their own benefits and what they wanted to know to be able to do. And, you know, the NRO and other organizations do that. But as far as an active organization that was trying to protect us, the individual, and everybody else from that, there really wasn't a standalone group that was, you know, trying to do this. Okay. And I don't know. But the idea of that being a thing that we're saying, no, this is a real thing, but there are people in the 1990s like, really, computer police? Do we really need that? Come on. And
this is part of what we're seeing now. And I don't think that these are exactly the same arguments, but to talk about a cybersecurity enforcement agency, you could say, well, the FBI does that. Like, why are we going to make a whole new thing when we already have people that are already, you know, taking care of it, and it's just going to fall under the purview of another organization, which I think is certainly a valid case, and you will get no argument from me that sometimes things tend to balloon in government budgets, very, very rarely go down. There was only slowing budgets as they tend to get bigger. But, you know, there is, you know, at the very least, in the world we're living in now, I think an organization set up in the 90s solely dedicated to citizen control over cybersecurity, citizen understanding and enforcement over cybersecurity, you know, might have been something that could have been interesting. It would have been interesting to see where that went in a world where we are now more aware of it.
So, yeah, the FBI does this. The issue with that is that, yes, and all it takes is one event, major event, whether it be 9/11 or something else becomes the hot topic, and then it no longer focuses the attention on that. Because when you have an organization that has a lot of responsibilities, FBI is responsible for everything from, you know, kidnappings to, you know, international trafficking to terrorism to all these sorts of issues.
They're dealing
when
with,
all of a sudden this is the issue we need to do, you know, in talking to FBI agents about stuff, the priorities, whatever, all of a sudden Congress tells them you need this as your priority now. And if you want funding, then this has got to be a priority. And you've seen how certain kinds of things just become less policed because of that. Now, the Air Force handles like 80 to 90% of sort of our space needs and things like this. And there's an argument to say it's like, really, it should just stay within the Air Force because they're trying to do this. But then there are arguments like, well, the Air Force has had some serious issues with procurement and some other. There's some problems there that have not been addressed that are still there, institutional problems, which demonstrate that maybe they're not going to be the ones to be able to handle. They should not be the ones to handle it, that we need a separate organization to do this. I don't know what the answer is. You know, all I'm trying to do is like understand everybody's point of view on this and the why, and not just go like, oh, this is ridiculous, you know.
I guess part of it will also come down to if there is any sort of organizational synergy from either having, say, talking about a cyber department, a cybersecurity department, whether it makes sense for that to be its own separate entity, mm-hmm. or to fund a new branch of the FBI dedicated to that as a way of connecting normal FBI operations with this new thing. I think there's a similar mm-hmm. thing with the Air Force and Space Force, whether they need to have, you know, direct synergy like that or not. You know?
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments that I've heard of against making it fully into the Air Force, is because the Air Force has been, some people argue, has been very poorly organized and very poorly handling some things, and some of their funding issues, like not unlike other parts of the Pentagon, let's be fair, have been really. There's institutional issues there, and the idea is like that we want to start over with a new organization because we've had this procurement problems. We've had serious issues with the way they've been able to do things for years, and we don't want to throw more money. And I don't know that any of this is true. This is, again, I'm just pointing to arguments I've heard. I have everybody I've experienced, the Air Force is awesome and super competent and whatnot. So I don't want to be like, well, Andrew said, no, I'm like, I have no idea. I'm just saying like, well, these people over here are saying this. These people over here are saying this. My job in anything is I want to like, well, what is everybody saying? Different parts saying, you know. But anyway, the pro of the idea is you start from the Army and the Navy both wanted to be the ones who were in charge of air, you know, back in 1940s, back when we were first, you know, forming the Air Force. Is the Army, you know, Air Force originally was under the Air Force was under the Army, and there was like, hey, let's have it, you know, be this, you know, just a division of the Army, because the Army saw the advantages of that. And it's funny because it's like, you know, you look at some like Army helicopter units and stuff, and they have cavalry logos because they actually were parts of cavalry units originally. You know, that's they were just battalions that eventually got reformatted into helicopter battalions. But a long time ago, they were using horses. And there's, you know, examples for that of why that's been done, you know, of like, but then it's spun out into the Air Force. You know, the Marines are still under the Navy. The Marines are sort of their own unit, but they're still under the aegis of the Navy. There's arguments for that. So I don't know. But if we want to address the overall who it's under, one issue, the need for this, I think there's a need. I think there's a need. And there's, you know, we get the why don't we spend the money elsewhere. It's not a matter of like, hey, let's do this because it's fun. It's a matter of let's do this because the amount of infrastructure that we have, we are increasingly moving towards information infrastructure as being a critical component to our economy and our safety. From satellites provide, you know, GPS signals to communications to internet to all these sorts of things, they're extremely vulnerable in space. And we've seen examples of that recently from Chinese satellites that have broken up. presumably accidentally, that have caused problems and have taken other things out of line, you know, have been problematic. And that is, it's getting easier with access to space, becoming cheaper as more countries are capable of putting things into orbit. And you can put small little objects the size of CubeSats there that could be capable of doing tremendous damage, to be able to react quickly and to be able to handle these things, I think is very, very essential. It's one of these things that we don't know how important it is until all of a sudden everything breaks. So
it seems to me that we are rapidly, the next 5 years are exponentially going to look very different in terms of how we think about space than how we thought about it 5 years ago, just because the access is going to be a lot cheaper and a lot different. And so as this is developing and as the world is interacting more with it on a more frequent basis, the issue isn't necessarily, to me, militarizing it as in like, well, let's make sure we have a space gun pointed at every possible thing that could be a threat to us. But more, we are developing rules of the road up there as it becomes more practically a different space than we had understood it. And there's going to, we need a presence, and we need a presence that is actively focused on it. Now, you can make the argument that the Air Force can and should do it, and that's fine. I'm not going to pretend like I'm some Pentagon insider that really knows the inner workings of everything. I would also presume that many of the people that have talked about this are not Pentagon insiders either, and I've just kind of read a few articles about it, and I can understand that. There's not a lot of people that really know how these things go. I will say, despite the fact that I think I'm here for any and every military-industrial complex overbloat argument, I'm here for it. However, if this is going to be yet another indulgence of the Pentagon, I think it's at least smart money toward the future in a way that I don't think some of the massive decades-long projects for yet another airplane that turns different colors but needs to be plugged in every 5 seconds is not where we need to be going in terms of getting the most bang for our buck money-wise.
So, Bryce, if you want, pull up on a map, go look up, type in Los Angeles Air Force Base. And this is sort of address a comment made in the comment section here, which is very accurate, is that we don't understand the scope of what we're already doing in space and what's going on there. And there is a Los Angeles Air Force Base. And what's particularly interesting, if you go to the satellite view, you'll see something kind of amusing about this, is you'll notice what this Air Force Base does not have.
It doesn't have a runway.
No runways. That's near the airport. Now, what you'll notice that's around it is you've got Raytheon, you've got the Aerospace Corporation, which is, you know, the Aerospace Corporation's interesting. Aerospace Corporation is a company that is responsible for building, designing, and handling satellites. A lot of the satellites, the government satellites. It's actually a government organ. It was actually started by the government because the problem was the Air Force and the government wanted to be able to hire engineers and computer scientists, et cetera. But because of the government salary structure, they couldn't pay them what they were getting paid in the rest of the world. So the government created the Aerospace Corporation, which is a private company, right? But it's owned basically by the government. And so they can hire people to go work for them basically using the routes. So when you look at Los Angeles Air Force Base, you see there's absolutely no runways there. But what they are doing there is they are controlling satellites, okay? And it's because their birds aren't airplanes, their birds are satellites up there. And so that is a big infrastructure point there. And that's also, SpaceX is nearby. That is a huge aerospace hub right there in Los Angeles. And so that's where, Air Force, I think Aerospace Corporation is something like 80,000 people, something crazy. So this is a company that's basically owned by the government, but it's a not government agency. But anyhow, it's very interesting because that it's a very, very big thing. You know, satellites, government satellites are huge, is a huge part of protecting our infrastructure, things like that. So,
yeah,
you know, and the argument's like, hey, the Air Force is doing this. Let's fix those, whatever issues we may have. They're the ones best sorted, suited to do this already. I have no answer, but I'd say that it takes more serious consideration than many people I think have thought about. Gentlemen.
Yes.
So I spent the last week in my Model 3. Not, I mean, I got out of the Model 3, the Tesla Model 3 sometimes, but I picked it up last Sunday and I've had it now for a week.
Oh, wow.
And I've seen the future.
Yeah? Yeah. Did you get the all the autopilot and the,
the
fancy stuff?
There's nothing like driving down a highway with the car driving itself. That is awesome, creepy, cool, amazing, what have you.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing thing. So with the autopilot, you double click the steering stalk, whatever it's called, and then all of a sudden you hear bing bing, and then it follows. It's got on the display, it shows you the cars around you. It's using its radar and its imaging to sort of see what's going around you, to try to figure out, you know, what cars are around you. And I drove it through the Malibu canyons with it steering itself through there.
Wow.
Which was, God, really,
you know, I'm like, why not try it like this? And an amazing, it's been, you know, amazing to see this. And you're letting this car drive, and I've done the thing, the summon thing, where I stand outside and I use my phone to have the car drive itself out of my garage. Wow. While I'm standing outside of it, which is like insane. Oh, you didn't know?
Excuse me. Hold on. Wait a minute. So you have it coming, because your garage is kind of treacherous. Like, yeah. Having driven with you to your apartment, like I've at times felt, man, I would not feel comfortable in this garage because it is a fairly tight turn. That thing comes out of your garage by itself?
Yeah, it doesn't do the turn, but it backs up out of the garage by itself. I can have it open up the garage door by itself too and then come out.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
But I mean, that's really nothing compared to when you're driving down the highway and you put it to autopilot mode and it is steering around curves. Or you turn the turn signal to say, hey, I want to turn, and then it waits for the right moment, and then the car moves into the next lane. And there are other cars, by the way. I mean, you know, like, you know, I'm not going to be a Tesla. Other cars now have these features. Although Model 3 got rated the best out of all cars as far as its lane keeping capabilities, even out of all Tesla cars. Mm-hmm. It is really spooky and neat and a lot of things. I mean, the first time I tried, you know, the autopilot, first I just did the autopilot, you know, just do a little bit on a highway. And now I just almost always do autopilot. I just sort of default to there. I keep my hands on the wheels, but I let the car steer and keep itself there. Because one of the things I know is that if some car comes at me from a blind spot or I'm not paying attention, tries to go into my lane, the autopilot would be like, oh no, we're moving.
Mm-hmm. How much manual control do you have over, like, the steering? Like, if it, say, lost, you know, lane recognition or whatever, do you have to, like, disengage it, or can you?
It'll tell if it can't see, it'll give you a warning, and it will automatically disengage itself because it doesn't want to keep control and it doesn't know what to do. So you have to keep your hands on the wheel. If you let go of the steering wheel for very long, it'll start to flash and tell you, like, hey, put your hands back on the steering wheel.
Interesting.
So would you say autopilot is the biggest thing that has surprised you? Because obviously you were very familiar with the product, and so I'm sure you were expecting things to be cool. But if not autopilot, was there something else that you were like, oh, God, I guess this is – I kind of thought that this was going to be different.
I mean, autopilot was the biggest – you know, that I didn't really fully expect I'd be driving through Malibu through the hills, you know, with autopilot steering its way through there. I did not, you know, expect that, you know, that level and that's in that to happen. And at only one point did it say, hey, you need to take the wheel, you know, in what would be considered one of the, you know, the most sketchy sort of driving situation you can imagine. Now, I haven't tried it in rain or other weather, whatever. And I've seen, you know, there, it has a little symbol that flashes when it tells you it's capable of doing autopilot mode. And I've seen that when roads where there's only like one marker on one side and then cars on the other one, it's like, I'm not going to try this. You got to do this. But that's been, you know, one of the most surprising things was how good it was, you know. And, you know, it's one of these things that it's like cruise control is in every car. You know, before we go to full self, you know, there's the incremental future, the idea that we talk about. There's the future when, oh, all cars drive themselves and we don't have to be there. Yes, and, but there's going to be a big period of time before then where you have those features like autopilot, where, you know, most cars will start to have those features where you just press a button like I do and it starts to keep its lane and everything's sort of handling itself by itself. You know, we didn't go from no phones to iPhones, you know, and Androids. We went from, you know, cellular to when you had the StarTAC came out, which was this amazing small phone. And then we had semi-smartphones. And then we got the iPhone. And we're going to see several years of autopilot, you know, reaching other cars. And to buy a car without cameras or radar or whatever attached to it is going to start to seem silly in a few years' time, in my opinion.
On the autopilot, how I know that some of the other autopilot systems are made for highway driving. Is this the same thing where it will do like just guidance, or could it do like city based destination oriented autopilot
yet? So it won't like go to an intersection and stop and turn or do anything like that. You know, that's going to be that'll be the next level sort of thing that they have. And you know, Tesla has, you know, they say they're 6 months away from, you know, or so they're going to be putting out some cool new self-driving thing. And so when they have a really good, you know, the full self-driving package, I'll upgrade to that, you know, and you can it'll either be over air the update, or you'll take it in and they'll put it in a motherboard. But autopilot, what it does is it keeps, you know, helps you stay in your lane that you're trying to do. It avoids the cars around you, and it'll change lanes if you tell it to change lanes.
Okay.
So. And it maintains a steady speed. And the dangers, like, I understand why people were having, you know, every now and then you hear about somebody was in, it was in autopilot mode and they got into an accident, because it's really good. And you can, you know, you can kind of convince, you know, like you've been driving down the highway and you need to go turn right. And you forget, like, no, this car will not turn right into an on-ramp yet. You know, I actually think the new update will do that, but it's like, it doesn't do that. You know, you need to pay attention, and you do. It's doing its best that it can, but it's evolving software, and it's designed to be kind of a more sophisticated cruise control, not, hey, it's self-driving, really. No, they don't tell you, they don't say that it's that. They try to be very clear about that, but, you know.
But it is seductive enough in its competence that you can expect it to be like, oh, well, but it can also do this other thing. And, you know, you have to remind yourself, not yet.
Yeah, if you don't, you know, if you're not, you know, I think it may be wishful thinking on people's part or whatever. I could see how people can decide, like, even though Tesla makes it, like, there was, you know, makes it very clear, keep your hands on the wheel and pay attention. Like, and I get that, and I understand that. There was a company selling something, and this is horrible, and it was a steering wheel gimmick that was like fake hands that would grasp the steering wheel, and you know, so you wouldn't get the notification.
The system?
Yeah, so you wouldn't get the notification to say, like, put your hands back on the wheel. And so, like, Tesla and the I forget DOT or forget which part it was, like, they shut that thing down fast, because that's a recipe for killing somebody.
I mean, at that point,
here's the brand new device that make sure it's a brick you put on your accelerator.
I mean, it's like, what if it's a device that overrides a safety feature? Not a good idea.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Anyhow,
that stuff's only going to get more insidious, too. Yeah. Like, people who, you know, will want to hack their way out of, you know, what they perceive as just a minor inconvenience. I think that will probably get worse before it gets better.
You know, I don't know. I think that the general trend has been with auto safety that even through protestations, be they annoyances or laws, that we have tended to understand that safety is kind of important in general, culturally. Like, you know, we went from seatbelts being something that we were like, kind of cool, to something that's mandatory and you can get fined for. And in general, despite initial kind of pushback, we've all sort of understood, just buckle your seatbelt, idiot. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe as things get better and better, there will be people wanting to kind of get that last bit of luxury without the tech being there, which is, I think, what we're seeing with stuff like that, little add-ons like that. But I don't know if it will necessarily become worse, or at least worse than where we are now, which is already bad. I mean, that's always the thing that we have to remember with auto safety, is that, like, the number that we look at, and this is always Brian's point, so I'll be making Brian's point for him, that, like, if we look at the number of auto fatalities now, like, 25 years from now, as this tech continues to get better, or if we're in a world of self-driving cars, we're going to look back at now and be like, what barbarism were we doing, like how we're like, we're going to look back at the sign of adulthood of handing a teenager car keys in a macabre, sinister way of like, you were sending your child like to the killing fields for what? So they could drive irresponsibly and risk their lives and the lives of others. Like, what fools we were. It's going to be like leeches.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't have anything, you know, instead of wait for the technology to evolve. Also, what's interesting too is, you know, this is a car that's controlled by your phone, like an app. Like you actually have a card, that an RFID card, but you have an app in your phone that's hooked up to Bluetooth.
Yeah.
So when you just walk up next to it, unlocks. Mm-hmm. And then when you open up the app, which is interesting, they have a thing, a loot box, because they're like their promotion thing is they encourage Tesla owners to push it towards other people, and they even have like everybody gets a referral code.
Right. I've heard about that, because you will get a little, you get like a kickback or something if you
refer. So mine is it's ts.la/Andrew92672. Andrew92672. No, but all seriousness, it is a very interesting way in which they're trying to promote the thing. Nobody's going to remember that on a podcast.
No one can rewind this. Or...
Nobody will do that. Anyhow, point is, I love it. Absolutely love it. I'm very, very happy with it.
Very nice. So,
and there's interesting, there are things like there's a camera in the center above the rearview mirror, which is aimed backwards, which is there's tiny little features like the glove box and the frunk in the trunk are all opened electronically. You have to do it through the center control console. And Elon Musk has pointed out exactly why this is that when full self-driving becomes real and legal, the idea that you would be able to have your Tesla car serve as like an Uber. Is go out there and drive people around while you're eating or doing whatever. And in doing that, you want to prevent access to the trunk or these other parts where you might store your stuff. So by making that all electronic, it can be an inconvenience on one hand, but the other hand, it's an advantage because this means that access to these things is limited.
Do they still have the safety pulls though on the inside of the trunk?
Yeah, on the inside, yes. I'm pretty sure they still have that because you know, if somebody's on the inside of the trunk, they already have access to the trunk. Other interesting note is that did you know that of all the Teslas that have been stolen since 2012, do you know what the recovery rate has been?
No.
It's like 99%.
Oh, because
in the US, yeah.
Because they have GPS and all, right?
Yeah.
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 So it's basically like a built in the last 10 years version of LoJack.
Yeah. You open up the app, it tells you where it's at. So,
Yeah, I know Sunbun in the community got a Tesla recently. And I think he had to go get it serviced or something, and he was able to track it as they were moving it around and
yeah,
you know, doing whatever service they needed to. Yeah. That's pretty neat. Yeah.
Yeah, so cool. So anyhow, that's my pick.
Tesla model. Look at you. I'm so pumped. I can't wait to ride in it. Obviously Tesla's a company that we talk about a lot, but I think what's fascinating about it, and if Tesla wasn't like literally the like second most hotly debated thing on my timeline and or Elon Musk in general, I think I would love to luxuriate a little bit more on the idea of like, hey, look, this is a car company that was invented recently. And I think a lot of those decisions that they're making, not only in the product, but also in like the fact that they don't buy advertising, like is really, 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 really interesting. And I think that we will look back, no matter how Tesla, the story, what the ending or ongoing story of Tesla is. This is going to be a fascinating business case study of like what happens when somebody makes a car company in a world where we thought we were done making car companies, or that the next car company was going to be these like headless speeding bullets that will dominate our self-driving bullets that will dominate our highways.
I, you know, one of the things that, you know, my observations about Tesla as a company, and I've followed them, you know, back when Wired magazine talked about Elon Musk, you know, is going to take this Lotus car parts and electrify them and do that to, you know, buying stock on the IPO and all this is, you know, everybody can choose what they like, what they don't like, whatever. It's fine. But trying to understand things, I think, is critical. And sometimes people don't like a thing and they decide they don't need to understand things, or they think they understand a thing well enough that they can, you know, therefore I feel this. And I think, and we're all guilty of this. Back in the day, I thought, saw that with Apple. You know, back in, you know, the 90s and then early 2000s, there was these opinions about Apple. Everybody had an opinion about what Apple is doing right or what Apple is doing wrong. And I was one of these people. I'm like, I think that the judge for me of this company is that people who buy their products, they might have gripes every now and then with them, but overall, they love the products. They love the products. And then when Apple did the iPod, and the iPod was this huge hit, you know, it was like, yeah, it was.
Hey, wait a minute, Bryce, or I'm sorry, Tim Cook. What would you say that they love?
They love our products.
Their products.
Yes. Our customers.
Bryce is limited one word impression of Tim Cook, but I love it.
It's very good.
Great product.
You know, that was a product that, and you know, we've talked about this, the famous Slashdot review of the iPod.
Sure.
Remember this? Yeah. You know, lame, you know, it was this thing, but and for that user, it was true. And that's the thing is it's like, it's a lot like music, you know, back when Britney Spears was big, it's like, 80% of people hate Britney Spears, but 20% love her and will buy her music. And that's what you need. You know, Kanye, most people don't like, maybe don't like Kanye, but enough people do that it's enough of a thing to be a hit. You know, it's not hitting, you know, majority, it's hitting enough to be sustainable. And so Apple had this in this. I remember they said, like, well, Apple's only 4% of the computer market. It's really only 4%. And then a year later, you know, it's only 5% of the computer market. And then it was like, it's only 8% of the computer market. I'm like, there's a trend here. You know, Tesla, I see that thing where, like, consumer satisfaction with cars, Tesla 3 years in a row. Top, by and large, the most satisfied customers in the world are Tesla customers. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean if you're not a Tesla customer that you're going to be a fan, but it just means that if people are buying a product and liking a thing, where is this thing going? And that's the curious thing to me. And so the future of this company, I'm saying, is like, there are a lot of really happy people who got these cars. I'm like, well, I heard a guy who, like, yes, when you have this many things and people are upset because delivery timelines, all these things, it's taking a long time. What they did in Model 3 is very interesting. If you opened up a Model S and you looked inside the door lock mechanism, you'd find out it was the same mechanism in like a BMW. Tesla's been building their own stuff, and they've been trying to do everything on their own, which, newsflash, it's taken longer than people expected. But now these cars are shipping. Now these cars are out there, and people like me are getting these cars going, oh, my God, it's amazing, and the closest equivalent that I can have to an experience is when I got my first iPhone. Mm-hmm. So
very cool.
What's the future? I don't know. But I just spent a god-awful ton of money on this thing, and I'm loving it.
Well, that's good. I mean, because, again, it is a gigantic expense. And, you know, I think that's a big question, is in a world where cars and mobility are not only something a little bit different than what it even was when I was growing up, you know, and kids seem to be less likely to want to drive as soon as possible because of mobility like Uber and Lyft and ride sharing and stuff like that, you know, you have to rethink of what a car is and how mm-hmm. to sell it and what people want out of it. And it's interesting to see.
TuneIn is built in. It's a great podcast player.
Hey, look cool. at that.
Hey, very cool.
Get your weird things. If you own a mm-hmm. Tesla, take a picture of you playing weird things in it, and we'll retweet it.
Send
That's
it
very exciting. Andrew, you're not allowed to do it because we know that you're a Tesla. Although we don't know if you listen to weird things, although you're definitely
on. The first thing my girlfriend said when I realized I'd tune in was like, oh, can we hear your podcast on it?
Great. <It's,
laughs> All right, Bryce, what's your pick?
I got to pick. I've been watching The Office, and I had forgotten kind of how great the show was. I've only been watching it for a few days, and I'm like in the middle of season 3 or something, but it, like, I'm not very far into it. Like, it's a, you know, the show ran for like 8 years, and I'm not even halfway through, but it feels like forever. It feels like they got so much out of it so early on. You know, you look at kind of the way single camera sitcoms are now, and the things that they did and did not pull from shows like The Office or something like 30 Rock, right? You see those influences through TV decision making now. But there's a very special charm to kind of what the show was. And so I've really enjoyed going back and watching it. I think it's on Netflix now, but I feel like there was scuttlebutt about it moving to Hulu or something in the future. But I don't know all the details on that. But The Office.
You know, it's a show that really did change television, and not only by the fact that it had so many stars on it that went on to become even bigger and better than they were at the time that they got that show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I remember when Modern Family first came on, which is in its own right a mega hit. I was griping to our friend Katie Dirks that I was just so annoyed that they would go to these mockumentary interviews, despite mm-hmm. the fact that, like, The Office, as was its predecessor, was ostensibly a mockumentary series. And I think the British Office, for having only two seasons, was able to hew more to that idea that these were two documentary seasons, where The Office, the American version, I think, certainly visually...
At the end of The Office, they lean into, like, it's a documentary and stuff. But
this is a thing, and that people, you know, are watching it, and the fame is kind of affecting these people. But
that's so weird in Modern Family. Yeah, you're right.
And I was so annoyed, but I'm like, but you realize just how, not only The Office, but just in art in general, there is, you know, there's that famous cartoon that goes around on Twitter, the, like, you made a thing, I made a thing, right? Where it's like, and yes, that on some level can be applied to people taking things that aren't theirs. But when it comes to art, once you see, okay, this is what a comedy is. This is what a modern contemporary comedy is. And for a while it was handheld camera, you know, or like single camera as it's called, as opposed to a three camera shoot, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. This is what a hip comedy looks like. And we want to be able to have, for a lot of different reasons, structurally, here's how the beats of this kind of runs. Or maybe it starts out that, like, okay, Modern Family is going to be a documentary about a family instead of an office. And then at some point they're like, hey, let's scrap the idea that there's actually a thing and we'll just take all these visual tropes.
Yeah.
But it is amazing to see gigantically how much that's changed. And if, like, you haven't watched it, I would insist on everybody watching it just so I can continue to take my haggard hipster hot take that I still prefer the British version.
Really? Oh, I don't like the British version very much.
I mean, I'm sorry. There's just so much. So much. And it's tight. It's only two seasons and two Christmas specials. It's just kind of perfection.
Have you watched any of those Michael Brent follow-up movies that they made? They made, like, a...
David Brent, thank you. No, I have not. I have not seen Life on the Road, the David Brent show, but I am certainly, at some point, I will watch them and I'll be excited.
I have.
Oh, yeah? What'd you think?
Well, and I would say the difference between the David Brent character and the Michael character is that, Michael Scott, is that in first season of American Office, is he was more like David Brent. And if you even look at the artwork from it, he was balding. He was this sort of, like, you look at, like, where it was positioned there. Then they changed it over and they made him more likable. They said, let's make him kind of like he's insufferable because he's kind of stupid, but he's still a nice guy and you're still supposed to root for him. What's interesting there is that, like, I always thought that, like, Jim's character in the American version wasn't as likable. You know, because, you know, the way he sort of tortured Rainn Wilson's character, you know, the Rainn Wilson character, you know, Dwight became a favorite character. And then some of the characters were set up as trying to be the really annoying ones became the likable, like Ed Helms, his Andy character, you know, became this, you just sort of, because it was, that was sort of the beauty of the American version, was you had these characters like, oh, okay, this is going to be our latest kind of, like, look at this idiot kind of guy. But then you got into the pathos of, why are they like this? You're like, oh, wow, this guy's had a hard life or something complicated here. He's got a big heart. And then you end up liking them more, which I kind of like, where the British Office is just, David Brent is just you in the later in the follow up episodes, you in the Life on the Road, you start to see him kind of realize he's a tool and sort of make adjustments to that.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, and this is from Ricky Gervais. He says the difference between the American version and the British version is that British people watch TV to find the misery in their own lives and understand it and commiserate, where American people watch television to find the joy even in the commonly miserable, which is, I don't know if it's true. I mean, take that up with Ricky Gervais, but I think
I think that reinforces why those went in the different directions. I think that I agree. I think that, that's why the American version, you know, took these miserable people and made them likable and made you know, Ed Helms and Rainn Wilson became two of the most liked characters from there, you know, and Steve Carell, you know,
David Brent versus Michael Scott. David Brent, you look at it and you're like, oh my God, this dude is exactly like my a-hole boss. Yep. Oh, geez, what an a-hole. Like, he's doing these same stupid things that my a-hole boss does. Where Michael Scott, you're like, you know, he kind of reminds me of my one boss. Like, yeah, he was kind of an a-hole, but, he's a goofball.
Though I will say, like, The Office was so big that Michael Scott started influencing office culture. Like, I think you kind of started to see people goofy in similar ways. I don't know. I look at The Office and I think of like all of the little quirks from that show that like my father has picked up on, and I don't know. It's interesting.
It is fascinating. And I do think that they are just different shows. Sure. Because the American Office is really successful in England. They run it on and many people prefer that version. But I would say that the British Office to me is probably more of a comp to something like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Okay.
Where you are, maybe even like if you want to go like in the vein of like Always Sunny or something like that, where you are dealing with a lot of people that are kind of defined by some of their worst traits. And if, you know, at best you can identify with them, or you want to see them twist in the wind. But even, you know, Tim in the British Office, Tim and Dawn, like they're both they're hurting people. Like and they spend a little bit more time on that than they do where Jim and Pam in the American Office is more of a traditional star-crossed lovers. Will they find each other? Will they, won't they? Mm-hmm. Which I think for a show that, I mean, I think that initial order, I think was still back in the days where they were making 20 episodes or something of a season. And it's like, you can't spend 20 episodes of like just mean people doing mean things.
Right. You know? Like, and by, you know, kind of about where I'm at now in season 3, or maybe this was near the end of season 2, where it's like, hey, the conflict resolution episode where it's Jim hearing all of these pranks that he's done, you know, one after another, and being like, "Oh, man, I need to grow up."
And then Jim's a jerk.
He kind of does, right? Where he part of it is him, you know, moving to another office, but like that character development is there, and that's good to see. You know, I think a lot of shows don't try to develop their characters, especially in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the conversation, people mentioned that British humor being awkward based. I would say that and Justin pointed out, like, we do a ton of that here, but we don't do it on broadcast. It's generally more on cable. Like, Curb Your Enthusiasm is probably the ultimate awkwardness based show that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious. But it's when you're on broadcast, the goal, broadcast shows, comedies, you got to have an 8-year-old watch it and you got to have a 6-year-old watch it. And that's why they tend to be much broader based. And when a show works there, it's interesting. But yeah, you look at cable and you'll see tons of examples of that here too. And, you know, and it's the back and forth nature. It's interesting because it's like office comedies. We can talk about, like, you go back to Office Space, but before that, really the Dilbert cartoons, you know, sure. You know, Scott Adams and sort of creating, you know, illustrating the archetypes of the boss that didn't quite get it in the middle management stuff. And then, you know, I think that's probably one of our, if you want to say what's a starting point for kind of like, oh, what is office humor? You know, and the success of Dilbert was based upon this thing we could all relate to. versus Andy Kaufman.
I would say like the Drew Carey show and kind of everything that sort of sprung out of those office scenes. You know, that's probably a good proto comp too.
Oh yeah. Oh, I totally. Well, I mean,
we can go back to Mary Tyler Moore.
Connection.
I mean, we can go further back to there, but I'd say it's like in the manager sort of thing like that. You know, and like certainly. You know, that culture sort of started to come to four, parts of discussion with like Dilbert, as it became, you see the cartoons everywhere because it was like, oh my God, this illustrates what I'm going through, you know, but
hey, I got a pick.
What all right.
It? I don't own it, but I will hopefully, okay. About a year ago, kickstarted a game. It's called Action News. It took about a year for us to actually make it, and I still don't have it in the kerfuffle of getting everything out to everybody. There was a mistake at our warehouse, so we don't have our copies yet. However,
I saw you tweeting all week or all over the weekend of everyone received.
Certainly I'm hyping it up a little bit for Twitter, but like I for real do not have my own copy. However. Down the road, our buddy Brett the Amtrekker Rounceville did get his copy because he has some other stuff that he is going to have to deal with, including the inclusion of a new member of his family. He's not going to be doing game nights anytime soon. So he dropped off this copy of Action News. I got to tell you, man, this is a sexy box.
It's great packaging.
It's a really good looking box. I think it's gonna look really, really great on store shelves. So you can get it now. ActionNewsGame.com.
That's right.
I'm very, very proud of it. Having gone through all the components and everything, I think it printed beautifully. There was a lot that kind of went into making sure that this was exactly the way that it was supposed to be. Part of the reason why there was such a delay on it. It was heartening to get it into my hands and to look at where all that time, money, and effort went. So do yourself a favor. Go get it. If you didn't kickstart it, then go buy it right now, actionnewsgame.com. If you did kickstart it, then go ahead and check your email, check your spam. Make sure that you are able to fulfill. There is one final email that you need to fill out so we can get your right address. To get it to you, if you don't have that, then just hit me up anywhere I am on social media and we can figure it out. Yeah. But go ahead and check it out. I'm very, very, very proud of it now that I know it's so pretty. If it were ugly, I would just try to sweep it under the rug. But it's a very pretty game.
It looks great. And I got my the explicit card pack also at the same time. And like the pouch that it comes in is great. It all fits inside the box, so you don't need to keep a separate like little mini box or whatever. It's like that's a really great design choice.
You want to know what that bag is?
What is it?
Weed bags.
Oh, that's okay.
For
yeah.
reason, it just like it's a great. We used it for the demos, and it kind of looks good. It is this nice matte black. Kind of thing, but when we were looking to source them, I'm like, oh Jesus, what were they called? And I'm like, I think they were weed bags. And so I was like,
I
googled weed bags, and it just popped right up. And I'm like, all right, I guess. But it is an element of a mass produced packaging that a lot of people haven't seen, and it looks professional if you just get a sticker and stick it right on there.
Very cool.
So I know I supported the Kickstarter, but I don't remember if I ordered the box or not. I just went through an Action News game right now, and I ordered it. It was painless. It was easy. You accept PayPal and Amazon Pay.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
A very painless process. I just clicked the PayPal button right on top of there, and that's all I had to do, and then it took me right through. And, man, thank you for a painless experience in purchasing your product.
We do our best here at Contender Games to make the people happy, give the people what they want. And what they want right now is Action News, the game of television news. You just made the news.
I have a non-Tesla pick, just a real fast pick. Saw this last night, and I had fun. And there's going to be a lot of caveats here. know what you're getting into. Okay.
Okay.
Meg. Okay. The giant shark movie.
I've heard that this is a surprise box office hit.
Yeah, it's doing really well. It's directed by John Turteltaub, who did, you know, the National Treasure movies. It's a movie. I read the book years ago, and the book is, you know, I mean, it is what it is. You know, it's like, let's do a bigger than Jaws, a big shark thing, right? And then there are sequels to it, whatever. It's, if you want to see a movie where Jason Statham goes head to head with a giant shark.
Of course I do.
And it is a movie that, you know, it is silly. It is dumb. It knows what it is. But one of the things I thought they did really well, they made the characters were likable, right? The characters were very likable. And that was the key. And that was, I said this to my girlfriend at the time. I said, you know, this is dumb, but the characters are really likable. I care what happens and I want to see what happens next. And it is, if you want, like, over the top silly. Yes, it is absolutely going to be that way. I mean, the comparison would be like a movie like Piranha, whatever, you know, the remake, where it's just there's comedic elements to it. It knows it's over the top, and it's I've had a lot of fun with it. I was glad I saw it. So,
yeah, I might try to go see this before my movie pass expires.
Yeah,
if they're still letting people watch movies this week.
Yes.
But I'm looking forward to kind of a big dumb action movie. I didn't even know Jason Statham was in it. I think the only trailer I had seen was the clip with the little girl underwater. So,
yeah.
That's the. I mean, we are in such an interesting kind of movie space right now that I think is kind of very evocative of the 80s and early 90s, where like the big impossible person who like you can't throw a big enough challenge at, in the vein of a Stallone and Schwarzenegger, are kind of like back in vogue in a way that I don't know if they really had been since those, with like The Rock and Statham and Vin Diesel. And like There are definitely now just genres, or the Rock specifically, and I guess Statham now too. It's like you're just literally we're in that vein where it's like blank versus blank. So it's like they're almost kind of like canonically, like not officially, kind of connected. Where it's like, all right, so we've seen The Rock take on a Mexican cartel and he beat him, and we saw him take on this. Well, now he's going to take on Godzilla, and then he's going to take on a hippo. And now it's like Statham, seen him do all these bank heists and he's been a gruff guy. Now he's going to fight a shark and we'll see if he wins. Spoiler alert. He probably does.
Yeah. It's yeah. And it's funny is that like, there's a scene, I don't want to spoil too much in it, but like he's got to react very quickly, where next thing you know, he throws on a tank and he runs and he jumps into the water, and everybody else is like, it just like on the boat, they're like, wow. 'Cause he's just like, you know, just does this. I worked with the guy, Donald, who was the supervising producer on my Shark Week show, which next year, Donald's like that. You know, Donald is like, there are points where like we're underwater doing something, and you know, he puts bailout bottles, extra oxygen tanks around there, and Donald's been down there, you know, long enough, and he needs to take care of something. He's ran out of his own air. Next thing you know, I see Donald swimming by, just holding a tank underneath his arm, breathing from it, fixing something, doing this sort of thing. And it's like, I've met this guy. You know, this is a guy that we were in Vegas coming back from something, and he's like, oh, I got a helmet we could use for this thing. And like, where'd you get that? Oh, it's with my wingsuit. I'm like, your wingsuit? Yeah, it's in my car. I keep it in my car in case I want to go do base jumping on the way back from Vegas. I'm like, of course you do. Of course.
I'm going to be honest. When you said he goes and pulls on a tank, I thought you meant a tank top, which is usually the action hero outfit of choice. And then
you got to protect those nips.
That's right. Don't want to get rash.
Yeah.
Cool. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.